You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ13. Just go to Indeed.com/PODKATZ13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
The Market Musings Podcast with Fairbairn and Russell. Well, welcome back onto the Market Musings Podcast, where our guest today, Alex Walker, the CEO of East Star Resources, is joining us. The first time that we're speaking to you, Alex. Thank you very much for joining us. How are you?
Very well, thank you, gentlemen. Thank you for having me on today.
It's good to be talking. I know we did our first interview on Stockbox just the other week. Well, actually, that's actually incorrect because I looked back and I did realise that we did speak nearly 2 years ago, which does take me back. I'm not sure where that came about, but you were on an audio-only interview 2 years ago. But yes, the first video interview of recent times was last week, and the first time on the podcast. Hopefully we can get to know you a little bit more.
A lot's happened since then, that's for sure.
Indeed, indeed, yeah. Well, of course, Kenny's joining us as well, co-host of the podcast.
Yep, great to have Alex, and yeah, it's nice to have you know, obviously I'm in Scotland, Mark's in Holland, and I believe you're in Kazakhstan, that's your base now.
Yeah, absolutely. And I tell you what, it's quite a nice day today, as you were mentioning. It is up in Scotland as well. I've got a view of the mountains right next to Almaty from my window currently, and it's absolutely stunning.
So what we do in this podcast, we allow you to sort of give us a sort of potted history of yourself, you know, a chance for you to tell us a bit about yourself, because ultimately you can have the best projects in the world, but if you don't have the right people behind these projects, then it's never going to work. So we're great believers that people invest in people. And so I'm going to open the floor up to you, Alex, and just go back as far as you want and just tell us your journey, really. And we'll jump in with questions at an appropriate time.
Goodness, Kenny, you're asking, you're giving the floor to an ex-stockbroker who I once did my company directors course in Australia, Australian Institute of Company Directors, and I was told I was acting as the CEO in my group, and the rest of the group was the board. And we had to make a pitch, and I basically talked at them until the time was up. And I got given it afterwards that was the CEO sort of taking advantage of the board, because it was, you know, an hour or whatever had been set for the board meeting. And, you know, a strong chairman should have jumped in and wrangled the CEO before, but instead he managed to keep control of the whole thing, which meant he got to do what he wanted. So, yeah, as I say, giving the microphone to me can be a little bit dangerous, but I'll try and keep it a precise. Well, why don't I just start in sort of Western Australia? You know, the start of my career is probably the best. So before that, you know, not particularly interesting. I was born in the UK and emigrated to Australia when I was two, so I've managed to wrangle myself a couple of passports, which is quite handy. And grew up in a small town in sort of southwestern Australia, south of Perth. Moving sort of into my early career was, I'd started in capital markets in about June 2007. And you know, for a lot of listeners, we'll probably remember those heady days. I managed to just catch the end of quite an extraordinary boom, markets boom in general, but certainly a mining boom, which was enough for me to borrow $30,000 from the bank, pretend it was a car, and chuck it into the stock market, and I turned it into about $90,000 in 2 months. And then I promptly turned it into $10,000 about 3 months after that, and spent the next couple of years sort of borrowing, trading my way out of that position and out of that that debt, thanks to sort of the crash that came at the very end of sort of 2007, start of 2008. And I think, you know, what that taught me pretty early on in my career was, you know, a very heavy, difficult lesson about risk. And so, I guess that sits with me quite strongly, and I take that through, you know, with most things that I do. And, you know, I think with E-Star Resources, that, you know, our portfolio kind of resembles that, because I know that exploration is inherently difficult. You know, you can have fantastic prospects, but for any number of reasons, and it doesn't have to be geological or metallurgical or anything, there could be any number of reasons why a project doesn't come to fruition. And I think, you know, spreading your risk a little bit across a portfolio is a very, very sensible approach. And that's basically how that company started. So I stayed in capital markets in Perth until about 2013, working for a company called Patterson Securities, which is now part of Canaccord. You know, quite a significant brand in metals and mining globally today. Mm-hmm. I then handed my notice in with the thought that I wanted to go to Europe and do something similar. My partner at the time had just finished her PhD, so we were sort of looking to escape. Perth felt a little bit small pondy at the time, certainly for people in their 20s. And then Patterson's told me that I should go and run an office for them in London. So it wasn't what I'd originally set out to do, but it was a really great opportunity for me to sort of find my feet and see the bigger financial world of London. And so I did that, you know, moved to London in 2013 and spent, I guess, about 7 years in capital markets there doing various things. I should say that, you know, being in Perth was an education for so many different reasons. You know, when you go through a mining boom, when you go through any boom, it brings out everybody. You know, all types of people get interested when money's being made fast. And it became... I got it wrong, I should say, at the time. I assumed that just about everybody I met was a bit dodgy. you'd have people come in and present, and you know, I had a pretty distinct lack of knowledge on mining at the time, albeit that's, you know, all you do when you're in capital markets in Perth. You know, mining exploration is 90-95% of what you're interested in. But it became quite clear, you know, you'd watch people present, you'd watch people, you know, with pretty irregular backgrounds, become CEOs of companies. And, you know, the more you started to learn, the more you realized that, well, you know, this company was, or this person was receiving, I don't know, rent on their apartment from four different companies, for instance, and things like that. So it was less about, it felt to me as a novice at the time, less about, you know, exploration success and more about mining the markets, which didn't sit particularly right with me. So I thought, you know, I thought I needed to educate myself a lot more to basically stop people pulling the wool over my eyes. And so I did a master's of mineral economics, which doesn't make you a geologist or a mining engineer or anything like that by any stretch of the imagination, but does give you a bit of a flavor and the vocabulary. And I think importantly, gives you a cohort, you know, gives you a network as well of people to draw upon. And I'm in WhatsApp groups with people from that cohort today. And, you know, some are running private equity funds, some are very senior in mining firms around the globe, and you know, various levels of you know, everyone's been advancing quite well in their careers. And it's a very, very handy sort of group of people to, you know, to rely on for information, for, you know, due diligence, for sense checks on things and so on. So, you know, that worked quite well. I don't think it made me any friends as a broker, to be honest, because I used to ask quite irritating questions. There was always a broker that was bringing in a company that wanted to promote it, and then there was this young guy on the floor who'd be asking about, you know, throughput and head grades and how they got certain recoveries and so on for people that quite frankly didn't want to be asked that question.
That was something I was going to ask. I mean, what was your, obviously quite a long career in various brokerages, Alex. Did you start on the floor? Was that your first entry and just sort of work your way up, or fast track route in?
Yeah, I spent the last 6 months of my degree in France. So I was a bit of a I missed out on, you know, the graduate recruitment things. I'd always wanted to do an overseas stint, and time again I probably would have gone for a year, but nonetheless I finally got my act together in the last 6 months of my 4-year degree. So my degree was international business and politics, and so I did my last 6 months in Dijon and came back to Perth, and was basically looking for a job. And one of my friends from university was working for an online platform, which is Westpac Online, which I got to say was basically a call center. Now, you know, I'm someone who worked on the checkout in Woolworths at the start of my university career. So I didn't, you know, I wasn't particularly precious, but nonetheless, I was ambitious. So I knew I didn't want to stay there for particularly long. I did end up on the complaints desk for Westpac, which I guess is probably the job that you give to someone with a fairly mild mannerism. And I used to laugh because people would show me the forums, the chat forums, and they'd be like, "Oh, the trading platform's gone down again. Just give Alex a call or ask for Alex on the complaints desk and he'll give you 3 free trades." And so I thought, God, I'm being named here. It's time to go. So that was my first 12 months. And then after that, yeah, I moved to what we call a full service firm as sort of a dealer's assistant with a more senior broker on the floor. And that chap actually, I mean, he was incredibly well networked. Again, you know, the Perth investment banking community is pretty incestuous, and everyone wears several hats. And he was also on the board of a company called Barminco, which was one of the biggest underground drilling contractors at the time. Hugely successful company. So, you know, that gave me all kinds of sort of knowledge and introductions and things like that, which was incredibly helpful for really just understanding the lay of the land, you know, how things work, who's who, and so on. So, you know, that along with the formal education was, you know, I think put me in fairly good stead, at least from a level-headed approach to investing perspective. So, yeah, that was that part. You know, during that time, I was also in the Army Reserve, so I joined that pretty much first-year university, and I went through Royal Military College Duntroon part-time. And I say part-time, it was nearly a third of the year I'd spend doing courses. It was every single university break I'd be on a 2-week or a 6-week course and probably two weekends a month. So it was a part-time job, but certainly required quite a lot of commitment. And I think is probably also one of the things that gave me the grit, which is a pretty, you know, becoming more common term of phrase at the moment in a world of entrepreneurs that you know, really now's timing, all these kinds of things are really important. But grit, and you mentioned, Kenny, want to talk about failures and it's failures and it's, you know, weeks upon weeks of being yelled at, little sleep, you know, working in a very high achieving peer group environment that I think helps build that kind of character and has probably put me in relatively good stead to pick up my family of 2 young children and a wife and say, "Hey, we're moving to Kazakhstan. I've got a great idea."
Yeah, well, life's a journey, isn't it? Sometimes you've just got to do something and then see how it pans out, and just sit and think about it and not do it. It's my attitude is life's not a dress rehearsal, so I'd just rather go for it and see how it pans out, and then you can say you've at least tried it. You know, it's life's too short. I mean, I'm over 50 now, and you're like, there's so many things. I wouldn't change anything, but there's so many things and opportunities that I'd done sooner that I just didn't have the drive and the motivation for. But for some reason, maybe in my older years, it seems to have came back now. So, I mean, I'm up for anything. I know that sounds terrible, but in the world of investing or opportunities, I'll take on any challenge, even if I've got to wing it a certain degree as well. You know, sometimes there's more enjoyment when you're presented with an opportunity or a project and you're quite trying to wing it. Because you soon realise that people round about you are actually winging it as well, you know?
It's a constant refrain, isn't it? You know, the looking back aspect. And I mean, for people that deal in capital markets, like you guys, like me, in essence, you know, your decisions are very easily recordable, I mean, accountable. And you can see that you didn't buy at the bottom and you didn't sell at the top and you didn't participate in this bull run, or you know, they're very, very tangible. So the key is to worry about that less but still take on the lessons without, as you say, wearing them as a regret. And, you know, I don't do that perfectly by any stretch of the imagination. But you have to remind yourself that's the purpose of being in this position. You know, when I was at Patterson's, I was on 100% commission from a very early stage, you know, so there was no safety net in your earnings or anything like that. And so that sort of helped also teach that risk profile. It taught me about saving. It taught me about, you know, diversification and so on. I mean, I had a good education, so, you know, it wasn't like I really had to learn it, but a good education sometimes doesn't help you, or more often than not, doesn't help you with the real life lessons of these things.
Definitely. But, right, so I can interrupt you when you just arrived in the UK, so I'll let you continue.
Yeah, so the UK was fun. So I moved there with my partner with Patterson's. Again, I mean, 2013 was a pretty horrible year. You know, it's interesting talking about horrible years. I mean, it feels like, you know, 2023 will very much be one of those in everyone's record books. Again, in terms of capital markets. So I probably don't need to delve into geopolitics now or today, but it's those are ultimately the times when the most money gets made. And I was laughing. I went around trying to raise money. I think it must have been about 2014, 15 for SolGold. And they had, you know, SolGold, for those that know it, and I'm sure plenty do, you know, have quite a substantial porphyry discovery in Ecuador. And I was sort of walking around with Nick Mather trying to raise capital, and it was near impossible. And we were looking at this thinking, and I've got several of these stories, looking at this thinking, oh my God, this has got to be, you know, one of the best drill intersections I've seen in God knows how long. I don't understand why people won't fund it. And the concept was that, oh, it's a big porphyry, and, you know, you come to me for $10 million today, but you'll be back next week for another $10 million. And they weren't wrong. You know, porphyries are expensive things to drill. There's no doubt about that. But you know, there was such a strong part of you that says, yeah, but that's the point. You know, the point is that you drill and hopefully by spending money, you're creating value. And SolGold was 1.5p during that visit. And I was unsuccessful. We you know, went to all of the right institutions, all the right people, all the normal check writers, and sort of no one would come to the table. And about 6 months later, they ended up getting about, from memory, maybe $30, $35 million out of Canada. And, you know, within 12 months, they were 25p. You know, so people would have made 15 times their money. But, you know, that was just very, very telling of what happens in these markets. These are horrible markets, but it's when the biggest gains are often made. And And, you know, when you're in mining, when you're in small caps, you actually spend a huge percentage of your career in these markets, right? So, you know, you stick to it, you apply your spending very sensibly, and you make sure money goes into the ground, and you make sure that the work you do will put you in the position to be that company that's 15 times higher in share price, you know, 12 months later when things recover. So yeah, that, I mean, look, that's one of quite a few stories I've got from my early London days. But 7 years in London, a few iterations, I became, you know, quite good friends with a lot of the, you know, investing community, the fund managers and so on. And one of those people who became, you know, quite a good buddy was David Minchin, which a lot of people, I guess, might know as the CEO of Helium One, now ex-CEO of Helium One, when they kicked off. And so we'd always chew the fat. I'd call David, who was working for a private equity fund that managed about sort of 450-odd million with an Africa focus. And, you know, the conversation was always pretty good. It was like, Dave, you know, I want to talk to you about this company. You know, look, can you take a meeting for me? It's a bit of a favor. I don't, you know, I'm not too enthusiastic about it, but nonetheless, you know, this is what it looks like. And Dave would inherently agree, or I'd say, look, actually, this one has got serious legs. I'm really impressed by it, and so on. And you know, a couple of those ones, you know, went through to the point of their investment committee as well. And so I think, you know, Dave and I hit it off because of that, you know, that honest approach to things and understanding of you know, intuition and analysis about the quality of company and the quality of people. And so we sort of said, oh, we'd try and work together at some stage. And then eventually we started this company, in hindsight, quite poorly named, because it's difficult to say, but Scandi Vanadium, which was vanadium in Scandinavia, in southern Sweden. Often people would ask, would say, oh, that's great, I'm really into scandium. We're like, well, sorry, but we're actually vanadium. So yeah, we probably should have thought about that one a little bit harder. So I think that's another lesson learned, which I like to think that we fixed with East Star. But so we started that company together. Basically, we pegged, literally just put in our own money and pegged ground in southern Sweden. You know, the concept was that it was a sedimentary hosted vanadium project, and by all accounts looked like one of, if not the biggest vanadium deposit in the world. I mean, I'm drawing back now, I haven't reviewed it for quite a few years, but I think we had three historical drill holes, ultimately about 26 kilometers apart, all with incredibly similar intersections of vanadium and grade, and one of those had outcrop in the middle. So and you know, we traveled there. We sort of I say we, David mapped the riverbed. I was kind of his field hand. I'd help collect the rocks and, you know, learn a little bit of what we're doing, carry the XRF and so on, and watch him do his job. But nonetheless, it was very educational for me, and I really enjoyed being in the field. And just learning that part, because certainly when it came around to my real part of the business, which was raising money and talking to people about it and so on, you know, unless you're there and you're living it and you know it and you understand, you know, the rocks, you can't talk about them in the same manner. And so I find that incredibly helpful, knowing, you know, if I can paint a picture because I was there and I've walked the ground and I've spent the time. So. So that was great, actually. I mean, it was great to start the company. We listed it on the Australian Stock Exchange. You know, we pegged the ground when vanadium was about $4. It listed when vanadium was $27, and then it spent the next 12 months going back to $4. So you could argue that our timing was good from a listing perspective, but as in getting it away, but certainly wasn't so good from a share price performance after that fact. And you know, the company had a few other issues. I think the capital structure wasn't particularly good. You know, there were people who wanted out because it was an RTO very early on, and, you know, it had been unlisted for a year and a half. The other problems where we had permitting issues. You know, we had quite a, it certainly felt like a very supportive local population, but there was a very, very loud minority. And they were loud in the fact that, you know, the politicians often thought that they represented the whole population. But, you know, David and I would stay in Airbnbs on site all the time and speak to people about who we were and what we were trying to do. And, you know, this was the battery revolution. This was us getting green energy materials from a jurisdiction that has, you know, low clean power costs and the demand for these sorts of materials in their steel plants and so on. You know, it makes perfect sense in these jurisdictions to be more insular in the entire supply chain for the metals. And but you know, if you speak to a rich person and say, you know, we're exploring for a metal here, all they can think about is a giant coal mine in Germany, and you know, it's a very emotional concept. And you know, we thought we went about it incredibly well, talked about rolling reclamation and very clean processing, which was our absolute goal. But nonetheless, it's hard to get some people off that pedestal, and we struggled to do that. And because of the laws in Sweden, they managed to hold up lots of our exploration for years. So we only got to drill 2% of our license. And funnily enough, that 2% of our license had an in situ vanadium deposit, lower grade than the other historical work that was done. And it was still over £1 billion of vanadium. So, you know, it just goes to show that there probably is the world's biggest vanadium deposit. Geologically, we were correct, but, you know, the stars didn't align to take that one forward. And to be fair, we would have pushed it, I think, a lot harder. We would have kept committing to it a lot harder, you know, despite the local headwinds, because I don't think that's the sort of thing that should stop a project which you can demonstrate scientifically can be done, you know, without any of the major, you know, or even minor ESG disruptions, which need to be taken into consideration all the time, right from the start of a project these days, and quite rightfully so. But the other issue we had was metallurgy was a little bit difficult. So, you know, we didn't quite crack the code on that. We got reasonable grades, but probably not the sort of grades that would make an economic project at that $5, $6, $7 a pound. You know, so it's not to say that it can't be cracked at some point in time for anyone who's listening and wants the world's biggest vanadium deposit, but you know, a little bit more time and effort needs to be spent. So there were two sort of major headwinds, and that was actually principally the reason that we started looking for additional projects, you know, in other jurisdictions. So, you know, there was lots of reasons to come to Kazakhstan, you know, from a macro perspective. But between David and I, we'd invested in and worked with companies all across jurisdictions all across the globe. You know, the big obvious mining jurisdictions of Canada and Australia, which are fantastic, you know, still have their own headwinds and their own expenses and so on. But also, we didn't really feel like we had a point of difference there all that much. You know, the local aspect of things is a really good way to you know, to sort of know that you're onto the right area, because someone's usually been studying that area for 20 years. And you can use that insight and that knowledge. So we didn't feel like we had that that point of difference. Africa was at the time going through a lot of resource nationalization, and still obviously does to and fro in that sphere from time to time. And Eastern Europe and Central Asia just appeared to be gradually climbing in interest in both, you know, the Fraser Institute's investment index. There was a couple of big sort of success cases. You know, Timok was one what was the name of it? Reservoir, I think it was. You know, that was a multi-billion-dollar takeover, and you had on the ASX had Adriatic, you know, which was a fantastic success, incredibly high grade mine, you know, that they it was a historical mine that, you know, that they went back and re-drilled. And the share price was doing fantastically well. And Rio Tinto was looking at lithium and so on. And so, you know, we got quite excited about this part of the world that it was untapped. If you can't quite say completely untapped, but certainly from a Western investor's perspective, it felt relatively so. We actually had a peer, well, I don't know if we could have considered them a peer, but they were also in sedimentary hosted vanadium in ferroalloy. Who obviously I've, you know, since moving to Kazakhstan, I've got to know a lot better. And they had an astronomical market capitalization compared to ours. And so one of the original thoughts was, well, we really like Kazakhstan as a jurisdiction. Maybe we can go and find, a continuation of their deposit, along trend where, there's folds in the mineralized horizon that give you the density for another deposit. So we came here specifically looking for that. Talken Samarok, the sovereign wealth fund, we'd connected with in London, and they assisted just in logistics and things like that, which was you know, very helpful. And we spent a few days wandering around the most gorgeous mountains. Again, me playing field hand to David. Watching him do his job, and ultimately we didn't find it. I mean, we did find it, but we didn't geologically it didn't offer the opportunity that we were hoping for. Mapping at surface just basically showed, I guess, not enough overlapping and not wide enough potentially mineralized horizons for there to be an economic deposit. So, you know, that idea stopped, but then we spent a few days in the office with Talken Samarok, and we looked through their database of projects, and we just got really excited. I mean, it was just, absolutely phenomenal. And so we thought, well, this is a jurisdiction we need to spend some time in. So we came back another five times that year, met with dozens of private project holders, looked at Talken's portfolios again, did a number of site visits. Went through negotiations on a couple of assets to farm in to some, and got an understanding of how business was done in Kazakhstan, or a lack of understanding, because ultimately most of those fell over, just about everything fell over. So trying to understand, and I think even today I've probably got a much better handle on it, but how you close a deal here is very different to, you know, call them asset liquid markets like Australia, where, you know, people horse trade assets for shares and things like that all the time. It's a lot less known here. So we would have reviewed over 150 projects, and ultimately we settled on the concept of pegging ground. But at the time, COVID had started. So this was throughout sort of 2019, all of those site visits. In fact, our last site visit was in February of 2020. And really interestingly, you know, we landed in Almaty after Astana, which is the capital. We landed in Almaty, which is the old capital and where I live today. And people were taking our temperature as we got off the plane. And we were sort of scratching our heads going, "What? You know, this is a bit weird. You know, you don't normally see this." You start doing a bit of Googling, and this whole concept of COVID was starting to come up. We didn't get sick, so hopefully we weren't the people that brought it back to the UK. So we certainly didn't get sick at that point in time. I did get sick later, so I'm not immune to it. So please no one blame us if anyone is drawing those conclusions. But nonetheless, the timing for that was obviously very interesting. And being an ASX listed company, a lot of investors had said to us, "Look, you need to focus on Australia. I mean, Kazakhstan sounds very interesting, but you can't even go there now." So this was obviously a few months later, into early to mid 2020. David and I, look, we didn't really want to do Australia. I mean, we kind of knew it was the right thing to do for shareholders. We understood and appreciated that. But we didn't want to be the people running that. I was offered, but because I'd moved back to Australia for COVID. Sorry, I'm jumping around a lot here, but my wife and I had our second child due in June in central London. Our first was at Chelsea and Westminster, and God knows, you know, all the rhetoric coming through. We did not want to to be having a baby at the hospital at that time, just with no support, no family, all that kind of stuff. You know, the information that was coming through was quite scary. So we managed to jump on a plane quite quickly, and you know, we packed up our apartment that we'd lived in for 7 years in about 3 days, and hot-footed back to Perth. And so anyway, we were in Perth. We ended up doing a deal with an ASX entity, and then spent some time doing a soft handover. You know, serving out long notice periods, helping manage the Vanadium portfolio, helping promote the West Australian one. You know, the share price went up about fivefold at its peak for that asset. So everybody managed. It was definitely the right thing to do at the time. You know, all investors, even from the original IPO at 2.7, you know, managed to make a reasonable return on investment. And David and I left. I wanted to really continue with the Kazakhstan concept, and David was trying to figure out what he wanted to do, and was obviously approached about Helium One, and the rest is history there. So he moved on to do that, and I moved on, you know, working for free for a year to turn the Kazakhstan concept into a reality. So yeah, that was probably quite a long, quite a long transition of London through to Kazakhstan. But yeah, nonetheless, when that all started to, you know, demonstrate it had legs, that's when I started speaking to my wife about, you know, potentially moving here. We were interested in doing something, you know, what we considered exciting anyway. An absolute credit to her. I mean, I'd been here 5 or 6 times. I knew how lovely Almaty was. And my wife moved, you know, the first time she'd ever set foot in the country was you know, with all of our bags and 2 kids in tow. So, you know, that was an absolute credit to her, and she's settled in incredibly well.
She's a definite keeper. So she is, Alex.
Absolutely, mate. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
No, I hope she's listening.
I don't think people appreciate how big Kazakhstan is either. I mean, of all the kind of countries that end in Stan, it's probably the biggest, I would imagine. I mean, I don't know, you know, what sort of comparable size. I mean, you look at it and it must be like, you know, half the size of the USA or something. I mean, it's huge.
I've not done. I think it's 2.65-ish million square kilometers. And there's a great website. In the early days, I did a couple of LinkedIn posts of it, but there's a great website where you can kind of pick up a country and overlay it, because I'm sure, you know, everyone knows these days that a map that you see and you grow up with in school is not particularly representative. It disproportionately represents, you know, in terms of size, Europe, America, and so on. And the southern and many other countries aren't represented as well. So if you pick up Kazakhstan and you put it on Europe, you know, it covers England and it goes all the way to Western. It's as big as Western Europe. And it's a very similar size to that fact as Western Australia. I think Western Australia is 2.7 million square kilometers. So the two are very, very similar in size and in so many other ways, you know, geologically speaking and in terms of discoveries discoveries undercover. And I say, oh, Kazakhstan is Western Australia in the 1970s, and it's meant endearingly, and it's meant geologically because, you know, Western Australia's had the benefit of now 40, 50 years of intense investment, you know, with so many, you know, exploration dollars being spent in the ground there, modern-day geophysics. I mean, you know, really looking undercover requires not just the modern day geophysics. I mean, this geophysics was invented in the 60s, but the processing power to interpret it properly has really only came into fruition properly in maybe the 80s and 90s. And obviously today it's considerably bigger than that as well, considerably greater. And then different interpretations, you know, the places like the Centre for Exploration Targeting at UWA in Australia and a fantastic example. The work that they do has helped uncover several deposits in Western Australia and in other places. And sometimes it's just a new, you know, geological way of thinking. So it makes perfect sense taking that technology, taking those geological brains, and applying them to a place that hasn't had a major discovery, or even really many minor ones, in about more than 50 years. And just about every single deposit in Kazakhstan was outcropping. You know, our Rudna-Altay belt is a perfect example of that. 70% of the belt's undercover. You know, you're supposed to, VMS belts have quite repetitive spatial frequency. So, you know, it's obviously it's not perfect, but you know, if you've got a deposit every 5 kilometers or a deposit every 3 kilometers or wherever it is, depending on that part of the belt. And where we are, you've got one deposit and then you've got cover for 45 kilometers where there's absolutely nothing. And then you've got three deposits and then you've got nothing for another 30 kilometers, which is where our licenses are. And then you've got another 5 deposits and, you know, the 30 kilometers where we are is undercover. I mean, it's not, you know, you don't have to be a geological genius to know that there's probably something hidden under there. You do need to have that level of expertise to find it. 30 Ks is a long bit of strike to know where to put the drill hole. But nonetheless, I mean, you know, just pure statistically, there's got to be these opportunities. And it's why you've got Rio Tinto here. It's why you've got Fortescue now investing in a big way. First Quantum's just come. Barrick said they're setting up an office. All of these groups were waiting for the mineral law to change, and then they were waiting to see it tested. So the mineral law changed at the end of 2018. You had less than a year of testing it before COVID hit, where very little could get done. You know, a couple of years post COVID, and now they're jumping in. You know, and everyone's getting quite excited because in these porphyry belts, you know, you've got a 2 billion ton. Copper deposit. It's principally it's an open pit in the lowest cost quartile production in the world, and Kazakhstan's probably the cheapest place in the world to dig a hole. And there's one of them. You know, there's one deposit, and these belts are huge. And so there's not obviously one deposit there. There's going to be dozens of deposits statistically, but the other ones that, you know, the only ones that are being mined are the ones that were really obvious. So people are starting to come here now to find the slightly less obvious ones, and it's not going to be too long, you know, and I certainly hope that we'll be one of them, you know, that these success stories will start to come out.
Yeah. I mean, just obviously, believe it or not, we've been speaking for 45 minutes already. I mean, I think
goodness,
it'd be
mate,
quite good just...
I warned you.
Yeah. I think it'd be quite good just to give us a sort of, just give us a almost like a helicopter view of the assets that the...
Sure. Well, I guess principally I've spoken about the VMS and that's certainly leading the portfolio. I mean, there's no doubt that every single investor in the world should be thinking very long and hard about copper exposure in their portfolio. You know, if you miss uranium or it's potentially still going, if you miss lithium, don't miss copper. It's easier from the perspective of marketing and so on, and it's incredibly obvious. There's a structural shortfall that's going to hit, depending on who you ask, but 2027, it's, you know, deposits take 10, 15, 20 years to find and grow and permit and replace. It's just going to be insane. So anyway, so that's principally our focus, and it makes a lot of sense. So with that, we've got our short, medium, and long term targets. Short term being ones that we have quite a substantial amount of data on and the real potential to turn into, you know, basically we are drilling or we will be drilling soon. So that's targets like Vakuba, which had 42,000 meters of drilling in it. We've got a JORC exploration target. Now the process over the next 12 months will hopefully be to convert it to a JORC resource. There's other targets on the license that have less data but look similar or interesting, or, you know, from surface, like Telovskoy, where, you know, there's big rock chip samples of massive sulfides at surface. So there's no doubt there's something interesting there. Old mine shafts and so on, we need to try and understand. Then we've got our medium-term targets, which are, you know, we did an EM survey that had that generated targets across our 800 square kilometres. You know, since then we've done mapping, you know, confirmed alteration at surface, confirmed the structures are the ones we want to be in. We're doing some, we'll be doing ICP analysis on rock chips and so on to get the fingerprinting correct to ensure that we're in the right horizon. And then hopefully they'll be drill ready next year. And then the long-term target is what else is there on the belt? You know, I mentioned that we've got 30 kilometers, but there's 250 kilometers of potential strike that, you know, that we'd like to try and understand better and start exploring, because Artemyevsky is a, you know, is a multi-billion dollar, you know, is a billion dollar company making asset. It's one that's just outside our license, owned by Kaz Minerals, 50 million tons at about 5% copper equivalent. You know, we could have one or two of those on our license, but across the belt, there's potentially quite a few of them. And so it'd be very nice to find more than one in time. So that's our principal asset. We've got two other assets, being the Chewelly Orogenic Gold Belt, and we were farming into a rare earths license called Telluric. And adding the Chewelly Belt, we had the most data on, so we drilled that initially. I think we've had great success there. We've demonstrated we've got a deposit with a more than likely intrusive related gold system on a belt with a number of highly profitable intrusive related gold assets and more than 10 kilometers of strike. So, you know, we'd like to go back there. We'd like to get stuck in and do some additional work, subject to funding and finance. But, you know, we have a small gold deposit and we think there's a potential to be a big one. So, you know, we need to try and understand that a lot better, and that's going to take more drilling. And then the Telluric rare earths one is also incredibly interesting. So geologically, it had a lot of information. It was an old deposit. It looked very much like an ionic clay, and you know, we had Dr. Rainer Elmes is one of the co-founders of the company with me, and he'd been the top sort of 0.1% of rare earth specialists globally. He's discovered and is building a rare earth mine in Namibia with JOGMEC, the Japanese government investment agency for metals. So he's highly intelligent in that sphere. You know, we spent about $100,000 on that asset, and you know, confirmed the grades, all very interesting. The leach test results, we would have liked to have seen better recoveries from the ionic aspect of it, but nonetheless was very encouraging, and has given us a good indication of how we might undergo exploration in that area going forward. So we just need to risk weight taking all these things forward. So, you know, when you're a junior company with limited capital, you want to advance projects as cheaply as you can, as best you can, and you know, not spend money drilling out a deposit that might not be economic. You know, you collect the data and you risk things accordingly. And you know, for rare earths, one of those things that you do earlier is metallurgy, and then otherwise you might leave it a little bit longer for gold or copper, for instance. And you know, our copper prospect has historically had 97% recoveries from copper just from flotation. So we're not particularly worried about you know, metallurgy in the VMS belt. So I've got it around a bit, but sorry, hopefully that's given you a good picture of where we're at and what we hope to be presenting to the market in the coming, you know, coming months and years.
No, indeed. I think it certainly does. I mean, what about, I just want to touch briefly on Kazakhstan, if I can, and that jurisdiction you talked about, it sort of the regulations changing and it perhaps opening up for mining now. Obviously, you've moved there. I mean, you've lived in different countries all your life. But, you know, it is a big thing to move countries. What's it like to operate in? I mean, clearly you feel that there's clearly an opportunity here to actually move your entire family there. To go and, well, hopefully grow this company, make a discovery.
Yeah, I mean, it's fantastic to operate in. It's not perfect. No jurisdiction's perfect. I would take it any day of the week over. I won't name names, but I mentioned the trouble we had in Sweden and permitting and so on. Mm. You know, in a year and a half here in Kazakhstan, we have acquired we started with four licenses that have been owned by Talc and Samarkand and transferred to our joint venture companies. We acquired another six licenses. You know, we've farmed into several, we've conducted drill programs in three different jurisdictions. We've done Helibourne EM survey. We've done IP. You know, I just can't think of a jurisdiction that a small company can achieve that amount of work in the ground. You know, and it's a vast, you know, being able to achieve all that means that the money gets spent very well, you know, because you can do things quickly, so you don't have this slow burn of overheads that you get with other companies that take a lot longer to progress their assets. So for all those reasons, it's fantastic. There's always things we'd like to tweak, you know, and to that end, E-Star and a Canadian company called Aris were two of the co-founders of the Kazakhstan Chamber of Mines. And we've had, you know, we've had Rio Tinto join, Fortescue Metals Group have approved joining. I think we're just waiting for their paperwork. You know, a lot of other local companies and international companies in the junior space and the mid-tier space are joining, including Turkish companies and so on. So there's maybe about 15, 20 of us at the moment. And, you know, that's to advocate for responsible mining and investment in Kazakhstan, and also just to provide a bit of a picture of how greenfields exploration is done in the international sphere, which usually starts off with big licenses and then shrinks smaller as you have success. And there's certain aspects of the mineral law which aren't perfectly designed for that, which make things a little bit slower, a little bit more expensive. So there's always tweaks we'd like to do, but you know, I think I'm happier here than I am in just about any other jurisdiction in the world that I've worked in, and okay. And certainly a lot that I haven't. So it's a great place, and it's incredibly safe. You know, my wife can go out for a night out with the girls, catch a taxi home, and has never worried about a thing. It's an incredibly safe jurisdiction for those reasons as well. So it's nice.
Good to hear. Good to hear. I've never been, but I have only heard good things about the country. So maybe it will be a place I have to go and visit one day, maybe when you've got some interesting stuff going on the ground. I do just want to cycle right back to the beginning, just briefly, when you talked about recognizing when companies or CEOs are perhaps BSing you. Surely the market is not full of that. Surely not. But there's definitely an element of story telling, though, isn't there? It's particularly with mining companies, you know, going through that development path. And yeah, there will be a certain amount of spin. It's always a line that, you know, certainly at Stockbox, we've got to make sure that we're being very transparent on that with the CEOs, and because they've got a story to tell. They, of course, they're effectively selling every time, aren't they? They're selling their company, or it's trying to sell interest in buying shares in the company so they can raise money to go and pursue it. I'd hope there's less bad actors out there, you know, like crooks, let's say. But I mean, you clearly educated yourself because you wanted to make an informed decision off of your own knowledge rather than taking what someone says at face value. So, I mean, how did that really affect you? And I guess in a sense that really does align you now with your shareholders. And hopefully you, this whole podcast hasn't been you just BSing.
Well,
I just go on.
Yeah, no, it's a good question. And it actually affected me quite poorly. It pushed me too far the wrong way early on in my career. I assumed that it was everybody, and that's just, you know, that obviously that's not true. And again, this is principally to a UK audience, but my analogies are mostly Australian. And I look at companies like Independence Group and like Northern Star and Sandfire, and just, you know, wonderful management, just really clever exploration and strategy and execution. I mean, you know, I wrote a very small thesis on Independence Group when I was doing my master's, and I just look at what they did early on, and, you know, they had all of these different licenses, they had the diversification, they farmed out, you know, their greenstone belt to Anglo early on when it was soil sampling and a concept, and managed to maintain 30% of it, you know, after their farming the whole way through to making hundreds of millions of dollars a year. And now they're, you know, I don't know what they're at today, $12 billion behemoth in looking at upscaling lithium. I mean, it's absolutely phenomenal. You know, the quality of the people that are coming out of this. But so I went too far the other way. I think I was just in the wrong end of the stick for a little while and was too, you know, shown too many of the dodgy companies.
Right.
But you know, the goal is to find the good ones, find out what they did, and then model yourself on that. And that's certainly how I picture things. You know, okay, going forward, Northern Star was a group of like highly qualified underground mining specialists who saw an opportunity and just raised the money, jumped at it, and again, just, you know, huge success. So you need to figure out what your point of difference is and then use it. But it's that diversified approach, I think. Yeah. So it sent me too far the wrong way for too long. But I'm back in the fold now. And I think that you can sort the wheat from the chaff. And there is still wheat and there is still chaff.
Sure.
But nonetheless, it's possible to do. And you need to be bullish. I mean, you can't be a junior mining company CEO without being bullish. You can't be an explorer without being bullish because you'll never drill that hole.
You can't be an explorer.
You know, you'll never drill that hole and you don't know until you do. So you have to be a perpetual optimist. You have to risk weight what you do and you have to apply sensible spending. But, you know, nonetheless, you have to be bullish. You have to be excited.
Nonetheless,
you have to get people to come along for the ride. And hopefully for everyone's sake, you know, that ride is successful.
Hopefully for everyone's sake,
you know, that's why I'm here. That's why I keep writing checks for the company as well.
That's why I'm here. That's why I keep writing checks for the company.
Continue to do so as long as I can afford to.
Continue to do so.
And if you were to finish off by perhaps, if you could share any lessons you've learned for investors who are listening, who might be deciding what companies to good investments, what companies to perhaps avoid. What would be the things that you've learned? I mean, you've mentioned things like quality of people there and quality of exploration, diversified approach. But any sort of key lessons that you might want to sort of pass on to investors that were you know a few years ago?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I mentioned the cohort that I built. You know, I can make quick decisions on things sometimes, but I tend not to pull the trigger on it. I mean, I don't pull the trigger on it, both for Eastar and any personal investing, without having a highly intelligent group of people that I put out the concept to kind of war game it. So, you know, I've got my WhatsApp groups that have a metallurgist, you know, mining economists, mining engineers, geologists. You know, I can run it past a lot of people to and which not everyone has the privilege of being able to do that. But, you know, try not to be emotional about these things. I think everyone knows that. And risk weight your portfolio, because even the best intentions and the most honest people still don't get it right all the time by any stretch in exploration. But if you can, you know, grow your knowledge base, seek information, ask hard questions, you know, to the people in charge, to me, and see what sort of answers you get. And if they feel honest, then, you know, that's probably a good start.
Yeah, I think that's quite good advice. Go with your gut, see how they feel. You can usually tell if something seems amiss. Well, thank you very much, Alex, for your time today. We are upon an hour there of the podcast, so thank you very much. Kenny, any final thoughts from you, Kenny?
No, it was great to have you on, Alex, and it's been a pleasure to listen to your journey, and it's amazing how life's journey takes you from various countries, and I bet you never dreamed of 20 years ago ending up in Kazakhstan.
Exactly.
Running a business, but...
Well, thank you very much, Alex. Good to do the podcast with you, and I'm sure we'll be speaking a lot more on Stockbox.
Thanks, gentlemen. Appreciate your time. And apologies for dragging it out so long.
That's all right. Thank you.
All right. Take care. Bye.
Yes. Bye.
Thank you for listening to another podcast from Market Musings with Fairbairn and Russell. Tune in next time.